Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 31 of the Alexis L podcast. And this is going to be an Evelyn Waugh special. I think it's quite long, and I talk about why we're doing it in the body of the podcast. But I hope you enjoy it. And if you do enjoy it, then we'll maybe do a deeper dive into Evelyn Waugh. I think there were also, Talal tells me that we've had quite a few emails about the whole vote for nobody idea. And that is that I think podcast 32 will be just me and Talal, and then we'll talk about all the emails and all those ideas. And Talal, you wanted to say
well,
about...
Well, keep them coming in, please. Those emails about Vote for Nobody Party, you can email alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Your thoughts on the idea, and if you want to stand as a candidate, what's your constituency, yeah, and what are you going to not bring to the table? Because the idea is that we don't do fuck all.
We have no policies.
And then, yeah, I just want to mention real quick... that our live show that we've talked about so many times at the Cartoon Museum that we did back in August. I know it's quite late, but we are uploading that. Well, I think I'm going to upload that at the same time as we upload this very podcast you're listening to now. We're going to upload that to the Patreon, and that's going to be for Patreon exclusive. So if you want to listen to our live show at the Cartoon Museum, we waited this long for it to air it because... We were waiting till Sandwich Bar finished and stuff before we posted it. But it's going up. Please go to patreon.com/AlexisLPodcast to support the show and get access to wonderful exclusive content like our live show at the Cartoon Museum. Thank you very much.
And now our Evelyn Waugh special. So I think it was in when I did Desert Island Discs, which confirmed me as the only Marxist to be loved by the British state and the British people, that I mentioned that I'd always been interested in reading not authors that supported my own worldview, but authors who challenged it. And the one that I mentioned was Evelyn Waugh. This led in the last few weeks to Penguin Books reaching out to me and sending me a kind of, they've released some of Evelyn Waugh's books in a new edition. And also asked if I would like to interview some of the people who wrote intros for. I'm tremendously excited that we're going to do an Evelyn Waugh, an all war, the usual war that we can conduct is, class war. But I'm very excited, as a huge fan of Evelyn Waugh, both the early works and the later works, to interview Paula Bairn and Barbara Cook, who wrote intros to, well, if you'd like to introduce yourselves and tell us how you contributed to the war canon. Paula first, yeah.
Oh,
who's in Arizona?
I'm in Arizona. Yeah. Seems very long way away from Evelyn Waugh. So I wrote a book about Evelyn Waugh, a biography, a few years back, which is really a biography of Brideshead Revisited. It was a biography of a novel, really. I always loved war since I was a young girl. My interest was sparked when I saw The Great Granada TV series back in the day when I was 14. So it was an honor when Penguin reached out and said, would I like to write the introduction for Brideshead? I really actually couldn't believe it. I actually felt really moved by it. And I'm not the sort of person who's moved by many things, really, but it did move me because I just did think about that sort of 14-year-old girl, you know, never would have imagined that they'd asked me to do it. So it was just a great honor. And it was just, I love Brideshead. So it was just lovely going back. And it was just felt, I just immersed myself in that world again. So I did Brideshead. And Barbara, who did you do?
Who did I do? I am introduced to Decline and Fall for the Penguins. So I've been working on Evelyn Waugh for nearly 10 years now, I think. I am the co-executive editor of the Oxford University Press's Complete Works of Evelyn Waugh, which are kind of pretty hefty tomes. And Paula gave us a lovely, lovely review of them when the first five came out. And I don't forget. Thank you, Paula. So I manage that project with Evelyn Waugh's grandson, actually, Alexander Waugh, and a co-executive editor, Professor Martin Stannard, who has also written many, many works on Waugh, including biographies. So I think I first encountered him as an undergraduate, and quite unusually, it wasn't through the novels, it was actually through his autobiography, A Little Learning, which was the last book-length work that he published. And it only goes up to sort of his mid-20s, because he sort of always planned to write more, but sort of died before he had the chance to do it. And it's really intertangled with Brideshead, isn't it, Paula? Because in the last sections of that autobiography, he's talking about his life at Oxford. And of course, that's what most people remember from Brideshead Revisited. So there's sort of life, work, sort of entanglements, and that's what really I find really fascinating. I love that in Waugh, how he uses his biography and sometimes other people's as well, when he's feeling particularly vicious. You know, there's characters that sort of get named after people that he didn't like, and they recur.
Mr. Samgrass.
Mr. Yeah. Samgrass. Mr. Crutwell.
Who reappears constantly, people who offended him.
Yeah, being sort of lampooned to the point where there's stories of them being sort of like, oh no, he's written another one, what's he going to say about me now? So I do the sort of the hefty kind of OUP academic ones, and it was just lovely to do the Penguin intro as well, because it's such a... it's just really nice to be kind of writing that kind of free, quite, I found it fun as well. I found it a lot of fun. So I hope you enjoy them too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I suppose we should just start at the beginning, really talk about who Waugh was and, you know, then the early years of his, I mean, Declining Fall was the first novel that he
That's
wrote,
right.
wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Just start there and kind of work our way through the career, I would think, really. It'd be the simplest thing.
Yeah, well.
So who was Evelyn Waugh? I always think that house that he always pretended he lived in Hampstead, but when you go past that house on the bus, it's clearly in Golders Green.
Well, yes. He, rumour has it, I believe this is true, that he used to go and post his letters from a different post box, so they'd have the Hampstead postmark on Golders Green.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it used to be a lot more rural, obviously, than it is now. And it is quite close to Hampstead Heath. So in the autobiography, he used to talk about writing. He used to talk about going across the heath with his nanny and going on walks, you know, sort of in walking up to the local shops. And there's some really evocative kind of scenes of sort of Edwardian London.
But I mean, who was he then? I mean, tell you know, who was he in terms of, you know, put him into society, into Edwardian society, really, if you could.
He could, I can, yeah. Paula, jump in if you, but he was the son of a publisher, which is actually really interesting. And it means that we are able to do a lot of work and research on him, because he came from a family that really valued keeping stuff. So he wrote a lot from a very young age. He kept a diary from basically as soon as he could write. He felt inadequate, I think, pretty much all his life, partly because he was very obviously not his father's favourite son. He had an older brother called Alec, who was supposed to be the prodigy. He was supposed to be the kind of literary maestro.
I mean, people often, or used to ask me at book reading sometimes, you know, how can I ensure that my child becomes a successful artist? And I would say, we'll be really shitty to them. It's a good start.
Do you think any of them taking your advice?
But I hope not. I mean, but it's sort of, I think, you know, parental tension often, you know, produces, sadly, the greatest artist, doesn't it, really, in various kinds of psychological cruelty, I think.
Yeah.
I know in my case, it's true.
I think it's interesting because he was the youngest son of two sons. And I think Barbara's completely right to say that he said, I feel secondhand, everything's shop soiled and secondhand. And he didn't really get on with his father. His mother coddled him and he loved his nurse. And I think somebody said, you'll never find a bad nanny in any of the novels because he just loves nannies. You know?
Right.
And he's kind about nannies. Like, you know, he's never nasty. But, you know, the father would say to Alec, oh, my son and heir. And, you know, he'd do all this stuff. And when Evelyn came home, he always felt like, as I say, shop soiled and secondhand. And I think the greatest joke, because he obviously loved jokes, even more, and that's why I love him, because I love a joke. And I think one of the best jokes, his father published Charles Dickens. And I just think it's just so brilliant in A Handful of Dust, which is probably his masterpiece, that poor old Tony, you know, is dies reading Dickens, bored to death by Dickens. And it's such a dig at his father. And it's just so funny that he, it's just his best joke, because his father used to read Dickens interminably to them on their bed. And he thought it was all a bit of a bore, really, Dickens. Mm. And I just think it was brilliant, because as Barbara said, Alec was meant to be the one. Alec wrote that incredible book, The Loom of Youth, when he was still at school. Mm-hmm. And Evelyn didn't want to be a writer. He wanted to be an artist. Alexi said, oh, I like drawing, painting, but he wanted to be a craftsman. And later on in life, Barbara, remember, he said, I just wish I'd been a joiner. I wish I'd just made beautiful things.
Yes. Yeah. I mean,
he did make beautiful things. He made beautiful
he
books.
He did. And I think he did sort of spend a lot of time arguing for writing as a craft rather than an art. He was really interested in structuring something. He was really interested in refining writing over and over again until it was absolutely polished and perfect. And so particularly you can see that in the early works. They're just so concise and they're just
I think that's one of the, you know, that's somebody who also hated kind of modernism, wasn't he? That he was talking about a kind of old fashioned, I think dedicated to a kind of old fashioned kind of craftsmanship. Maybe I'm misreading.
Well, it's a really
that,
funny
really.
Mix, to be honest. Mm. I think he was really influenced by modernism as a young man. He was in Oxford in 1922. Can you imagine being at Oxford in 1922? You know, the year of the wasteland and just this amazing stuff. He went to the cinema when it was sort of a brand new kind of medium for mass entertainment. He wrote cinema reviews in the university publications. And a lot of his early technique kind of talks about kind of cinematic cross-cutting. There's a lots of stuff about dialogue. And so I think there is a lot of modernist influence. And then, of course, later on, you might be thinking about sort of his very famous comments and interviews about James Joyce writing gibberish, which is pronounced gibberish with a hard G, which is just
gibberish. Under the influence of Gertrude Stein.
Gertrude Stein, yeah.
You see a man going mad writing gibberish.
Gibberish and, you know. Utter nonsense. Which take it with a pinch of salt. The most outlandish statement should always be seen as sort of provocative positioning, I think, with war.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm mentioning A Handful of Dust that I think there is the most heart-stopping moment in all of Western literature, really, in that book, really. I don't want to spoil it for anybody, but I just, when the first time I read that, it's just,
I think we both know what you mean. I think we both know what you mean. Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's just extraordinary. And then that ending as well is just staggeringly good, really, I think, you know. Sorry, carry on.
So I was just going to talk a bit about going up to Oxford, and clearly although he liked to sort of present himself as the kind of naughty second son, in fact, when you look at his schoolwork, he went to Lansing. He was actually really brilliant as a boy. It was very clear that, you know, he started literary society. He worked in the library, and he didn't really like to sort of show that part of him. But in fact, it is there. But it was really when he went to Oxford and he was taken off by this crowd of really flamboyant aesthetes who mainly were from Eton. And I think one of the reasons that he wrote so brilliantly about them is because he was an outsider. Like, he never really used, he didn't fit in. He didn't go to Eton. And he said, I could have done. He said, I was clever enough to go to Eton, but he didn't. So I feel for me like he is always the outsider, and it just gives him that perspective. And that's why he can be sort of simultaneously inside and outside. He can be really callous and he can be really cold, but he can also be incredibly warm. But I think he was the first to say Oxford transformed him, because he met friends he loved. He fell in love in Oxford. And I think that's really just so important. And when he came to write Brideshead, it was all those memories came flooding back. And, you know, he was in the midst of the war when he was writing Brideshead. But I just think those years in Oxford, and Barbara, you've edited a lovely book about Evelyn Waugh and Oxford, haven't you?
Yeah, Evelyn Waugh's Oxford, yes. I looked at that period through sort of three different lenses. I looked at the idea of it being a place that actually was very stimulating for him creatively. And as you said, Paula, because the people he was mixing with were people who had experience of kind of continental art, and, you know, they've been to places and seen things that, he hadn't from his fairly provincial position in Golders Green. And so he was, you know, producing a lot of work. And quite a lot of it kind of visual arts, as we said, he wanted to be a craftsman. But then it's also sort of later on, you get the kind of the memory of Oxford coming through in the works, and it kind of comes through differently depending on where we are in the timeline. So the stuff that he wrote about Oxford when he had recently gone down is very caustic, very ironic, very satirical. And then you get the sort of nostalgia of the kind of Bride's Head, and that comes through in his autobiography as well. And then coupled to that, you also have to deal with the idea that Oxford was always an imaginary place for him, because his father had been there. In fact, his father had gone to New College. So he always had an idea of what Oxford would be like. So when he first got there, and to be fair, found it a little bit underwhelming to begin with, he was always sort of searching for what is the real Oxford? What's the heart of Oxford? Where's the bit where he was really into Alice in Wonderland. So he's like lots of metaphors about going through little doors into gardens and things. He wanted to go through that door and just have that kind of wow. And thankfully for him, it happened. I think it doesn't necessarily happen to everyone, does it? I mean, lots of people.
Well, there's two novels that sort of hinge, isn't it, that I can think of in a kind of catastrophe. At Oxford, the first is Decline and Fall, and then the yes. second one is Sebastian being sick through his window.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think the sick thing really happened, but whereas in Bride's Head, Sebastian then fills the room with flowers, that's sort of wish fulfillment. I think the sick happened, the flowers did not happen. As far as I know, he was never debagged in the quad. I don't think
presumably. Somebody else was. I don't know.
Frequently, yes.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, to return to the idea of war as the outsider, really. That, I mean, in many ways he wasn't, obviously, but kind of bourgeois, you know, artistic upbringing. But nevertheless, there's a kind of... But I mean, I mean, I don't know if it was war. I mean, this is jumping ahead in the sense that he was... People later called him a castle creeper. Is that somebody who was... obsessed with the aristocracy and, you know, I mean, the real, real high aristocracy. And I mean, a modern kind of comparison would be Julian Fellowes, really, I think, who's somebody who's also, I would think, is a castle creeper, is somebody who... But whereas Julian Fellowes writes stuff that just supports and doesn't satirize the aristocracy, that war... knew himself so well that he was kind of revolted, I think, by his own sycophancy to some, or maybe not. It seems to me he was revolted by his own sycophancy to some degree, and also saw, you know, he also saw advantage in it in that he could write about it. I'm hopping about a bit.
Well, I'm thinking that, Paula, if there was ever an opportunity to talk about the Ligon family, this would be it.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. I'm not of that view. I don't think he sucked up to the aristocracy. In fact, what his aristocratic friend said, it was quite the opposite. We sucked up to him because he was so funny.
Really?
He was so funny. He was so lively. Everyone loved him. And they said, the Ligon family said it was to be in his company was everything they wanted because he was so brilliant. And so he was, just to talk a little bit about the Ligon family, who were the model for the Marchmont family, he met Hugh Ligon, who was a very good-looking, gorgeous, gorgeous young aristocrat who had an older brother who was a dead ringer for Lord Brideshead. He was stuffy, and they took the mickey out of him. But Hugh was really a very close friend of Evelyn. They were probably lovers. But Hugh, even at that time, had an alcoholic problem, and he died very young of alcoholism. And then later, Evelyn met the sisters. There were a lot of sisters in the Ligon family. Their father, Lord Beecham, was exiled for homosexuality. He was outed in exile by the Duke of Westminster, who was his brother-in-law. And so for the best part of 10 years, War lived in this aristocratic house with the sisters. And they said he was like Shakespeare's Puck, from A Midsummer Night's Dream. It was just like having Puck in your family, just this little sprite who was just so funny. And they would read Jane Austen together, and he would write books, and then he'd do drawings of the Liggins. And they always said they found it really odd when people said he sucked up. They said it just wasn't the case. And then when people accused him, and Bride said, he said, "Have you actually read the book?" He was like, "Boy Mul,"
yeah.
And he was like, mm-hmm. "Boy Mulcaster." I totally satirized him. How can you say I suck up to the aristocracy when I write a character like Boy Mulcaster? You know, he's like, "Are you serious?" But he did have a gift for friendship, Evelyn. If he liked you, and if he liked you, he was loyal. And he used to joke with the Liggins, like, because they were so rich, he would write them checks for like £1 million as a joke, and they would just, you know, laugh about it. And then in later years, they're fortunes reversed, and he really did send them checks when they had no money.
They
were living on their own, and they you know, that wheel of fortune, he became the successful person.
Really? Okay.
And he was so loyal to those friends. So when I wrote my book, I was like, I wanted to turn that on its head. I was like, I don't believe anybody who's so vile would be beloved by so many women and really had this gift for friendship. And I wrote the book on that angle, just saying, you know, this is not the full story. This is not the full story. And then I met Alexander, his grandson, at a party and told him I was doing this. And he said, just come on down. And he's become one of my best friends. It's hard to believe, but so funny, like Evelyn, like honestly, just crack. I mean, Bob, you know him.
I love him. he's a lovely man.
So adorable and so funny. And like, I would go and stay with him and I would just be crying with laughter. And what's so extraordinary, he has his artifacts that are talked about in Brideshead. So he's the elephant foot, waste paper basket, and the fruit. So Harold Acton gave them all to Evelyn, and Evelyn gave them to his grandson. So, you know, going to see his house, I was like, oh my God, that was in Sebastian's room. And then we'd be picking up these sort of artifacts. And the point of that is that gift of friendship, you know, and I always in my work try to tip things upside down a bit and just say, is it really that simple? Why was he so loved? Why, you know? And so I don't really believe he sucked up to the aristocracy. I mean, who wouldn't love, you know, the benefits? Let's face it. He drank champagne every night and had, you know, and he loved beautiful things. He was an aesthete and he absolutely loved beautiful things. So he loved to be surrounded by beautiful things, but he always satirized the aristocracy, and he couldn't quite understand why people said he sucked up.
I don't have people on my podcast who don't reinforce my worldview. So, you know, I'm going to end it here.
Okay. Well, I hope you're not compassionate then, because he was also incredibly compassionate. I think he was obviously a difficult man. I mean, I often wonder, you know, Paul, you're saying he has this gift of friendship. I was thinking, well, would I have been one of the people he approved of? Would we have got on?
No,
would it have been funny?
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't.
Thanks, man. No.
I mean, surely there was a... I mean, I accept your different analysis, but he wasn't hanging around with, you know, coal miners, was he? I mean, he did only hang around with the aristocracy.
I mean, that was his set. You know, like, he...
Yeah.
And like, he had his bagman during the war was from a very working class background, and he absolutely loved Evelyn. And his bagman, but people interviewed him and said, oh, was he must have been this horrible snob. And he said, no, of course, he was absolutely charming and lovely. I don't know what you talk about. And people were always trying to get this back, you know, to his man to sort of say bad things.
Yeah.
And it couldn't have been more charming. And Bob was right. He was difficult, but he was difficult with everyone. So, like, even with Mary Liggin, who he loved, and with Dorothy Liggin, he could be so sharp. Like, he wasn't nice to them because they were from the aristocracy. He didn't speak. Dorothy was late one time. Late for lunch. He didn't speak to her for a year. You know, he was irascible with everybody, and he was a difficult man. But I just think I hate that sort of black and white reading of him. That but he said I moved in that set. I went to Oxford with that set. They were my people. They were his tribe. And so, but I never saw any elements of sucking up. I found that he could be really quite harsh.
Really? This is very unsettling. I don't like this at all. I've always had a little speech about war, about the satire came from kind of self-loathing, and it's upended my whole world now.
Sorry.
I don't know where to put now. So.
I'm 70. I'm 70 and you're making me learn new things.
I'm sure there'll be loads of people who'd agree with you, but I mean, I know when I wrote that book and I met the family and the war family, and they just said, oh, they said, thanks for doing that. They said, because we did, you know, he was really lovable and he was really funny and he was really difficult. And they said, thanks for doing that, because up until then, everyone had such a negative view. And I think,
including me,
they were so sort of delighted, and they were like, you really got the joke. And they were like, you got the joke, didn't you, Paula? You got the joke. Alexander, you got the joke. And I was like, of course I get the joke. You know, if you get the joke, then you get the joke. And I say, that's not to say that he wasn't difficult. It's not to say that, you know, I just feel that he has been misrepresented.
To roll back to talk about Put Out More Flags, which is, I mean, in some ways a minor work, and it's not in this collection, is it? It's been excluded. But apart from, I mean, there's Angela's alcoholism, but there's also a very innovative piece of writing in that there's, it's pretty explicit that it's kind of incestuous relationship between Basil Seal and his sister, really, isn't it? Which, I mean, it's again, which is handled with tremendous delicacy in a sense, but nevertheless, it's
his sister's Barbara as well, which always makes me feel a little bit more.
But I don't know how that was, I mean, because one of the things about war is, you know, those books, those early satires, the subjects that they dealt with was so, you know, I mean, practices and clearly like homosexuality that were illegal at the time. And
he revised quite a lot of stuff. So Decline and Fall, and I think this did make it into the Penguin intro, is that he named some of the characters in that who were kind of seen pretty obviously homosexual, and they're very kind of flamboyant, and there's these sort of house parties where, you know, they all sort of go, and you know, they're sort of the place to be, but also quite sort of counterculture. And he named two of the characters after real life people that he knew. At least one of them was an Etonian. And the names that he gave them were so similar that he had to change them. It did make it into print. The very first impression of the book has these names in that very close to real life characters.
Is that a collector's item then, presumably?
They're worth a fair bit, I should think. Yeah. But it's it was like, if you think about the seriousness of that, as you say, homosexuality was illegal. So the idea of naming living people. Pretty much. I mean, he didn't exactly name them, but, you know, he kind of, I think it was sort of Gavin Gaythorne Hardy.
Gaythorne Hardy, Brodie.
Yeah, Gaythorne Hardy and Brodie and Saunderson and Henderson and Saunderson, you know, so it was really very close. So he could have done them a lot of damage. So he changed those names. And, oh, but my favourite kind of name that he had to change is from, you know, Lord Beaverbrook, the newspaper magnate. Well, he appears in Scoop, I think it is. Paula, correct me if I'm wrong. But he was called Ottercove. So Beaverbrook,
right.
Ottercove, which I just love. And that's his silliness. That's the silliness of his humour as well. But right. So yes, I've digressed from whatever point it was. Censorship, difficult subjects in the early novel.
Yeah. Well, I don't know whether, I mean, there's a couple of, there's a few books that are missing from, I don't know whether they're more problematic. I mean, Black Mischief is the other one that's obviously missing from this collected.
Well, that's got, I mean, the funny thing about that is we look at that book now and, well, it's an issue for anyone that's working on writing of that period is that, well, they're not going to use the terms that we use now, and the political outlook is not what it is now. Mm. What's interesting about that book, though, is the things that might make it kind of, might pause, you know, give a modern audience pause for thought, were not the things that made it controversial when it came out. The things that made it controversial when it came out was its portrayal of extramarital sex, basically. It was considered kind of blasphemous. And the other comments to do with, well, I mean, it's a whole other subject to talk about, you know, racism or otherwise. I could talk to you for 2 hours about that in Black Mischief. But it was, what is interesting is at the time it was the sexual stuff and the supposed blasphemy, which really upset war. because he just converted to Catholicism.
Yeah.
So to be blasted by the sort of Catholic kind of great and good for writing a supposedly blasphemous book was, you know, very, very upsetting to him personally.
Well, because seeing that we are hopping all over the place.
It was my fault that time.
That's all right. But we might as well get on to the other kind of thread in his life, really, or one of the other primary threads in his life. That there was obviously there was two C's, wasn't there, in the 20s and 30s. There was either communism or Catholicism, really, and you jumped into one or the other, and both, sort of Graham Greene went for both, I suppose. But, I mean, the whole wrestling with, I mean, Catholicism, which obviously is a central part of both, primarily Brideshead, but also, sort of Honor Trilogy as well, really. Is a fascinating, but in a way kind of, you know, you kind of think, what are you worried about? You know, tell us about, Catholic, you know, those authors who converted to Catholicism in the pre-war period. Why did they do it? You know, et cetera, really.
Ooh, who wants to go first?
Paula, you've been quiet for a while. As it's very prominent in Brideshead, really.
So we're talking about Evelyn Waugh's conversion to Catholicism. And as Alexi says, lots and lots of his fellow writers did convert around that time. Evelyn Waugh, he was quite religious as a boy. He was brought up in the Church of England, and he was quite religious. And his father wrote this funny little poem saying, "Don't go over to Rome," when he was a little boy. And at some level, I'm like, are you just really putting two fingers up at your dad?
Right.
You just did not want him to convert to Catholicism. And as he wrote this little ditty. But it was very serious for Evelyn Waugh. And a life without God, I feel, it wasn't a meaningful life for him. And I think he was drawn, as I said before, he was an aesthete, and he was drawn to very beautiful things. And I think he loved the beauty of the liturgy in the Catholic Church. And I think he loved the beauty of Rome. And he converted to Rome after his first marriage broke down, and then married Laura Herbert, who was in a prominent Catholic family. And for him, it was a way of sort of belonging to a family. You know, I think the family thing's really important. I think Brideshead about falling in love with a family. And I was just reading the diaries even more yesterday, because I was thinking he must have read Howard's End. I was thinking about that moment when she says, "I fell in love with an entire family." And I read, and there in the diaries, he says, "Oh, I've just read Howard's End, falling in love with an entire family." And because he didn't love his own, he didn't feel accepted by his own family. The Catholic Church was a family to him. And as Barbara says, he took it very seriously. He raised a lot of money for the Catholic Church, a lot of money. He took it very seriously. He didn't like to talk about his faith. It was very private to him. But he did have the zeal of the convert. Like, yes. He was very zealous in his Catholicism. Lots of friends were, you know, during that terrible political time, and there was so little meaning that the World War II was coming. And people were converting. He fell in love with a girl called Olivia Plunkett Green, and she was Catholic. And that was when he first fell in love with Catholicism, through Olivia and then Laura. And I don't really know why the other friends did it so much. I pretty much understand why Evelyn did it. I think I understand what he was drawn to. But I'm not so sure. And he did, of course, he's friends with Graham Greene. And I'm Catholic, so I understand. I'm like, I get it. I know what's going on here. But it did annoy his family, and it did annoy some of his close friends that he converted. But he took it very seriously. Barbara didn't, whether you think.
Yeah, I mean, well, his father, I'm pretty sure he referred to it as what his son's perversion to Rome. He was very, very anti. And for some reason, sort of arguing against this very early on, which is just very, very bizarre, like to your little boy. So in terms of the social context, well, you've got to remember that Catholicism was still kind of relatively newly freely practiced in the country. I mean, and it took a long time for those sorts of prejudices and taboos to kind of fade a little bit. So it only becomes sort of, you're only allowed to kind of do, you know, do certain things like be an MP, for example, or whatever, sometime in the 19th century. It sort of goes through a few generations before I think young people think, oh, actually, this is something that I can do. I can do without, you know, sort of embroiling my family in some kind of strange social outcast situation. So there's that. There's one is that it's sort of, I think, possible in a way that it perhaps hadn't been a few generations before. Oxford itself was well known as a sort of centre of Catholicism and Catholic learning. You might have heard of the term the Oxford movement. There were some very charismatic priests who, you know, were sort of studying at Oxford, going up to Oxford. And so were a big influence on these young men's lives. I think also that idea of like two fingers up at your father, I think that was a sort of generational thing as well, because we're coming off the back of the First World War. These are a lot of young men who've seen their brothers go off to fight and quite often die on the orders of the establishment. So becoming Catholic is also a kind of anti-establishment gesture at this time. It's sort of saying, oh, actually, no, I want a different tradition. So for all those reasons, and yeah, and for some reason, there's this sort of group of really very kind of dynamic, imaginative Catholic convert writers. So yes, you mentioned Graham Greene already, Muriel Spark as well, Antonia White, who I absolutely love. Antonia White, she's just brilliant, who wrote the Frost in May quartet, and she writes very movingly about being a convert in that. But I think the idea of home and the family, Paula, is just so important, because when he had friends who converted to Catholicism, he would say, welcome to the family, welcome home. And there's a beautiful letter he writes about how being converted is like coming home after a really long journey and your own bed's been made up for you and the covers turned down and you're home. And I was just like, oh. this idea of this sort of safety and protection and love.
Yeah, yeah. And we see that in Brighthead, don't we? Because in Brighthead, you have to read it backwards, because Charles is a convert to Catholicism, and the hints are there very subtly, and it's only at the very end we realise he's a convert. But what I love in that is when, you know, when Charles is testing Sebastian in the early years, and he's saying, "Oh, come on, you don't really believe in the ox and the ass," and Sebastian says, "Well, I do rather. It's a lovely, it's a charming story." And then he says, and then he says, "You know, do you believe in the supernatural?" And Sebastian says, "Well, of course I do. Of course I believe in the supernatural. All the things that Evelyn Waugh believed in when he was writing Brideshead." But I love the way he tests it. And the funniest, one of the funniest parts of Brideshead is Rex Mottram's conversion to Catholicism. It's absolutely hilarious. Yeah. So Rex is saying, "Well, I'll convert so I can marry Julie. What do I have to do?" And of course, Cordelia very naughtily teases him and makes him do all sorts of ridiculous things that are not Catholic at all. So he's, again, he can even satirize the religion he loves so much. He's never above taking the mickey.
Yeah, I mean, don't you think that he knew, in a sense, that, I don't know, the there was a utilitarian aspect to his belief, really, that he needed it, that he... I don't know that he, there was an aware. I mean, the thing that seems to me about war is that there's always a kind of self-knowledge, really, which what makes him an exceptional author, that there was still a bit of him that knew why he was doing it. Don't you think there was a kind of a bat squeak that, you know, that he knew that it was a choice, in a sense? I don't know.
Well, I think it's a sort of, he talks about it as, I think he talks about this in the beginning of The Ordeal of Gilbert Pimfold, which is the book I've been working on most recently. And he has a character in that who's very closely modelled on himself. And he talks about it as being just an acceptance of something that is necessary and logical. Like, so for him, the world just doesn't work without it. Right. And so, yes, I suppose you could say that that is... He knows what he's doing, but it's a sort of, yeah, it's a kind of capitulation, if you like. You're like, okay, this makes sense. This is the only thing that makes sense. Because we mentioned a lot about the kind of support and the idea of homecoming. The other thing is that the faith and its doctrines provided a sense of order in a world that seemed very chaotic, very disorganized and very dangerous.
So yes, and I think that's why that's why it seems to me that people went for either Catholicism or communism, was that the coming out of a world of chaos of the First World War, that they were looking for an all-encompassing kind of ideology. Communism appeared to provide that, and so did Catholicism, I think.
I love that he said, people say I'm really nasty. What would I be like if I wasn't Catholic?
I suppose that was a bit, I mean, we were talking before about, you know, having the acerbic friend, but then he went, it's a sort of whole new level to then put your caustic nature or your caustic observations into a best-selling novel, isn't it? That's taking it to a whole other level, in a sense. So he went beyond, above and beyond in that way. I mean, was that a thing? Was that an issue?
Yeah, I mean, when he was asking his friends, when he was writing Brideshead, one of his best friends was Nancy Mitford, the novelist, and he wrote to Nancy and he said, "Now listen, you keep your ear to the ground. I want to know what all the friends are saying. You report back when this is my magnum opus. It means a lot to me. It's the book that means the most to me." And she wrote back and she said, "It is the Liggins, too much Catholic stuff." So, like, even his own friends were like, "The Oxford bit was brilliant. The Catholic stuff, forget it." Like, you know, even his own friends. And he was quite upset because he was more sensitive than probably we realised. And he really hated offending the Catholic Church. If he ever felt he was offended, he would write these letters to the powers that be and say, "I never would be offensive towards the Catholic Church." It really meant so much to him.
Didn't stop him doing it.
But it didn't stop him doing it because he's a novelist, no. You know, and he's always going to do it. And we see that. I mean, I think Sword of Honor is fantastic. I think it's
completely... Well, that's if we could, yeah, we could. I mean, that's my particular area of expertise. Okay. I think that, I mean, not that, I mean, obviously, you know, the other stuff as well, but yeah, we haven't really talked about Sword of Honor that much, really.
And, you know, Guy Crouchback, his Catholicism is so deeply embedded in him. And we really, I think it's very underrated, Sword of Honor. Why is it your favourite?
I don't know, really. I mean, it's the one that I reread. It's the book that I would reread the most and learn new things. I mean, partly because I'm interested in kind of military, military affairs. So I think it is in many ways the most effective depiction. Now, it seems to me, I mean, I've never been in a war, but it seems to be the most effective depiction of warfare, you know, that I've read, really. I mean, completely unheroic. Often, I mean, you know, the British Army is amazingly inefficient and kind of idiotic. And but nevertheless, in the end, you know, achieves. So I suppose there's that. And I like Guy Crouchback as a, I mean, is Guy Crouchback a kind of variant of Charles Ryder? I mean, there are certain similar, they are the same person to a degree, really.
Well, that's a whole series of alter egos, aren't there, like going all the way through. So, yeah, you've got Charles Ryder, you've got Guy Crouchback, Basil Seal, who we mentioned in relation to Put Out More Flags. Mm. Yeah, I mean, most of his protagonists, I would say, are kind of, again, very self-conscious versions of an alter egos,
Do you know, there's a really funny story, Alexi, that I think you'll like, about Evelyn Waugh. And he was during the war, he was in Yugoslavia, and he was with Randolph Churchill, Winston Churchill's son. And they had a love-hate relationship. When they got on great, they got on great, but they could fight as well. And at this one point, Randolph accused Evelyn. Evelyn was very courageous, and he would walk out on the fields in white clothing and would attract the attention of the Germans. He didn't care. And he often put people in danger. And one point, you know, Randolph really shouted at him and said, "What the fuck are you, sorry, you know, what the hell are you doing wearing white, you know?" And and then, so anyway.
It's been my fucking career has been fucking swearing. So
I'm a bit late to start worrying about the
fucking
video start,
worrying about it now.
Sorry.
Especially on a fucking podcast. Yeah, go on.
This is absolutely brilliant vignette when, you know, they're having this row, you know, the son of the prime minister and Evelyn Waugh, and Evelyn says, you know, "Can you just shut up?" And he says, "Look, have you ever read the Bible?" And he's not really said, just read the Bible from start to finish. And if you do that, there's a bet. I mean, they bet a few pounds on it just to shut Randolph up. And then Evelyn said, all you could hear was Randolph saying, "God, such a shit." They've read all these stories about Moses and, oh, what a shit. And he said, he loved it. And Ramta was like, "What a great book the Bible is." And it's just, it's just a lovely sort of vignette of in the war, like German, you know, bombers raiding them. And then he's like, "Just read the Bible and shut up. You're going to fed up with you talking, you know."
Yeah, I think it's a real sense, isn't there, about like how much of war is hanging around waiting for things to happen or being sent to the wrong place. Which, you know, sort of makes up quite a lot of the narrative, doesn't it?
Yeah. And also, I mean, I think what I love about Sword of Honor is how it mutates and how many kind of sub stories. I mean, this is fans talking, really. It's not going to, anybody who's not familiar with the oeuvre, I think, is not going to get a lot of this. But I mean, the whole storyline of Major Hound and Ludovic and the, you know, this kind of sorcerer-eyed, weird kind of corporal in the guards who, you know, kind of murders, you know, it's beautifully hinted at. It's never explicit, really, and then ends up as a romantic novelist. I mean, this is just a, I mean, the kind of, I mean, again, we're coming back, I suppose, to the craftsman. What I love, what I try and do as an artist and what War does is not, is to reduce and reduce and reduce, is to not, you know, have an idea and then write a novel about it, but is to take an idea that you think might be worth a novel, and in the end, it's a single sentence. And that's what's the density of something like Sword of Honor, I think, is the stunning characters. Mm. I mean, so many, you know, the whole story of the Thunderbox and... You know, I mean, that whole... You know, I mean, just staggering level of detail and brilliant satirical...
Oh, yes, and a war novel that features an exploding toilet, you know? Yes. That somehow still hits you on an emotional, intellectual level, you know.
And I think later on, the sort of portrayal of, I mean, there's not many people, I mean, one of the reasons that I read War is because it's not about people that I know, but there is Gilpin, the communist in the later, in the Yugoslavia chapters, I think is an amazing and very real portrayal of a cold-eyed communist, I think, really, you know, in a way, of a kind of certain kind of British kind. And then there's the other one, isn't there? There's the academic who's completely in love with the Yugoslavs, you know, the kind of romantic communist who loves the partisan, who's dementedly in love with the nature of the kind of partisan suffering and stuff. I can't remember. Katamar, is it? I can't remember the name of the character.
Yeah, anyway, and yes. I think, again, it was like a family, because when he first went to the war, and he was one of the first to sign up, he was very brave.
And the halberdiers is, in fact, the Marines.
And he really felt a sense of home. Again, this sort of search for home, I think, is always in him. That, and the army felt like a home, and then he felt very disillusioned. And
he talks about like a marriage, doesn't it? That it's first he's in love, and then there's this sort of gradual disillusionment.
And that's in Brideshead when he says, he felt like a bridegroom who's no longer in love with his wife, and I think the Sword of Honor shows that. And War was very drawn to these sort of old Etonian, dignified people, but then found they were flawed. And I think that's so. Bob Laycock is the person he most admired as a human being, and he really did blame Bob Laycock for the Crete fiasco, which he called, he said, let's have some medals, the medal should say excretia, because it was a shit show, you know. And he felt dishonored, he felt they ran away, he felt it wasn't British, and his faith in Bob Laycock. He works that out in the Sword of Honor. These people that seem to be so charming, so erudite, so clever, so brave, but in fact aren't. And it was a terrible disillusionment that set in with the army. And this is all what I feel with Evelyn. Like, he's always disillusioned. Like, is it Catholicism? Is it the army? Is it love? Is it friendship? Is it the aristocracy? Is it novel writing? It's a sort of search for home, I find, that we get over and over again. And he never quite belongs. Somehow he's always an outsider. For me, that's how I see him. He's not really part of the crowd, not quite.
And then there is that, I've forgotten the character's name, the show jumper, who is sort of who escapes when he should have stayed and got killed. And that's based on real, is that based on the whole just Crete debacle,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. I forget, Claire.
Yes. Either Claire.
Ivor Sinclair. And he was based partly on Bob Laycock and partly on somebody else, but because he didn't want Laycock to know, because he knew that Laycock had run away. He felt Laycock had behaved dishonorably as a soldier, but he couldn't. And then one time Anne Fleming wrote to him and said, oh, come on, it's clearly Sinclair's Laycock. And he wrote back, fuck you, Anne, fuck you. And he didn't want anyone to, he was really angry about it. He did not want people to know, because he still admired Laycock, but that's why I'm saying he was very honourable in his own irascible way. He didn't like the thought of running away.
Yes.
He didn't like to be thought of as not honourable. And I think that honour is really at the heart of him. And that's what I see when I see him. Do you agree?
I think that's his sort of... his saving grace, if you like, for me, is that kind of tenacity, that steadfastness. And, you know, he will not be moved by kind of personal gain in the way that he often sees other people, like, sort of, so he will be sort of seduced in by this idea of, you know, the higher ideal. And then Sword of Honor is, as we've been saying, like a kind of a story of like discovering the hollowness of what he thinks he's fighting for. And I think it's also why he likes being drawn to flawed people, because there's no pretense there. They're not sort of setting themselves up as some kind of...
Well, I suppose that is always the that is always the central driver of the satirist, isn't it? It's tremendous. Is the satirists, in fact, are the biggest believers.
And then disappointed.
Them, yes, yeah. Us. Yeah, I would class myself as that. It's through that disappointment that the satire, the great work comes out.
Anger of things not being as they could be or could be.
There's an amazing speech that Ivor Clare makes about, he says, and Guy Crouchback doesn't know about his disgrace, but he says to him, what would you do if I challenged you to a duel? And he says, well, you know, I'd laugh at you. You know, he says, you're ridiculous. But there must have been a period when if you were challenged to a duel, you know, there was a period when it was a tremendous dishonor to refuse to fight a duel. Then there was a kind of interregnum, a changeover period when it was kind of like, was it serious if you were challenged to a duel, or could you just say, fuck off, you know, don't be ridiculous, you know? And I'm fascinated by that period when, and that's what he's talking about, because he says, you know, the running away that I did, in another 50 years, I'll be applauded for it. But we're in that kind of mid period.
I think for me, the Sword of Honor thing, like, and particularly the idea of loyalty and what is owed to others and what is owed to yourself. I mean, we're talking about the Yugoslavia bit, and there was actually part of that. So Evelyn Waugh would often first publish a short story, which was then the sort of the seed of a longer part of one of his novels. I mean, it happens quite a lot.
I love Dickens, is the most...
Well, exactly. Yeah. Yes, being the last chapter or two of The Handful of Dust. And there's a short story called Compassion, which is about the Jewish refugees.
Yes. I can't... You know, last time I read Sword of Honor, I can't read that bit anymore. With the couple in there, it's so upset.
It's devastating. It's absolutely devastating. So yes, you know, to cut a long story short, these are people that Crouchback learns to care for, you know, doesn't feel much kindred with them to begin with, and then sort of sympathizes with their plight and can't save them, can't help them. So he's talking to, I think it's a priest, and he says, I couldn't do anything. It was completely worthless. It was completely useless. And the priest says, well, yeah, but what did it do to you? You know, what's that experience done to you? Well, you know, what has it told you about yourself? So, and I just think that's so interesting in terms of, you know, a man of faith, a man of principle. You know, like what have you gained from speaking to these people and genuinely wanting to help and putting yourself on the line to do it? What has that told you about, you know, your way of life and your, you know, what is important to you and what matters and what is worth fighting for? So I mean, that's the kind of exact opposite of fighting for an empty ideal, isn't it? You're kind of like trying to defend some real people.
I'm failing.
And he fails. Yeah, he fails. Yeah. So it's not heroic.
No.
It's but yeah, what does he learn in the process? I just found that really, you know, sort of like, sort of, it was wasted. It was wasted. It's like, well, it wasn't wasted effort because he was trying to do the right thing. I would
read
that.
That's the message in a sense, yeah.
Or I don't know, Paula, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I think he was a principled man. Just a very funny man. I mean, as I say, his army friend said he was completely hilarious. He would sometimes take classes and he would do it in a very satirical way that the soldiers would be crying with laughter. You know, there's again this image that he was unpopular. It flies in the face of a lot of people who were soldiers with him and said nobody, when he wanted to be, nobody could be more funny about his situation as well. And we've talked a lot about the self-knowledge of him. He knows what he is. And I love people like that. They know they're flawed. We're all flawed. And he knows he's flawed. And he doesn't pretend to be flawed. And yet he's still in pursuit of this ideal of the Bob Laycock. He wants to believe in Bob Laycock. He wants to believe he's a man of integrity. But Bob Laycock isn't a man of integrity, you know, and you just sort of feel a hopelessness, really, and that sense of the ideals somehow letting him down, if that makes sense. But
I think it's a bit more about the pursuit than the, like, I think this is the thing, and it's what connects for me, the idea of book writing as a craft and the idea of the faith that he had as well. And it's the idea that perfection, or, you know, the ideal is worth pursuing, even if you know it's not actually achievable. So yes, you'll be let down by people that fail you along the way, but that continual quest, whether it's to make the perfect piece of writing or to live a better life or to attain, you know, a state of grace, may not be available to you, but what you can do is work towards it and keep working. And I think that is, you were saying, you think he's driven by the idea of home. I think for me, that's what drives him, is this idea of, like, yes, it might not be possible to aim for perfection, but that doesn't let you out of trying. It's still your duty to try.
I could just go on talking about the minutiae of you know, so many, talking about individual scenes in so many of the books, you know, the comic kind of invention, the end, and I suppose also the, you know, in a sense, like Shakespeare, how he's comic, you know, how he has contributed to the language as well. I mean, the one I was half-assed quoting, the bat squeak of desire, which is used in The Line of Beauty as well, isn't it? I can't remember the author now, but when he meets...
Hollinghurst.
Yeah, actually, Alan is a really good author, I think. Nice.
And that book he said was a retelling of Brideshead, because he was obsessed about Evelyn Waugh. And I think her beauty...
But he says it when it just... I mean, it's a novel that's fallen out of fashion, but he's a gay guy who feels the bad squeak of desire when he meets Margaret Thatcher. Yeah. Well, there's a complicated proposition. Yeah,
I think the other Hollinghurst book, The Stranger's Child, that definitely owes a huge debt. That's like a love letter to Brideshead as well. So,
I think that line, her beauty rang out like a peal of bells. It's really beautiful. And I'm really glad you said that, Alexia, about the language, because I think some people have accused him of purple prose in Brideshead, but it's incredibly moving language. His father had died, and he really let himself go. And when he talked about... when he talks about what love is, and he says to know and to love another human being is the font of all wisdom. It's such beautiful, soaring, gorgeous language that we don't really associate with Evelyn Waugh. And it's incredibly moving. And it is a book about love. And he writes about love just so beautifully in that book. And I think sometimes that could be overlooked in the pursuit of it's just a suck off to the aristocracy. Well, it's not actually, it's a love story.
Stop pointing out the barrenness of my previous views. Don't make me look bad. Are if you fell a scouser and you're making me look bad. Are Amy's. Are leave us alone. is there anything else we haven't really, I thought we'd sort of do a kind of trot through the life and then end with the lace.
Yeah, we sort of got excited, didn't we? We sort of peeled off in his mid-20s.
Yeah, we went a bit mad.
Yeah, I don't know whether we should just leave it there, or is there anything else anybody wants to say, really? I don't know.
I've got a couple of questions.
Yeah, all right, yeah, go on then.
Also, like, you know, we can give any of our audiences who haven't read his books, and myself, the chance to, if they've been intrigued by this episode, to read some of his work, and then we can do a reunion episode down the line and then go into a bit more of the minutia of the books and stuff like you mentioned. I don't see why we couldn't do that. That would be fun. But through the interview, I've written down a couple of questions. I'm only halfway through his first novel, Decline and Fall. And Captain Grimes in that is, like, quite clearly an alcoholic. But you were talking about how his portrayal of alcoholics is quite compassionate. But I find Grimes was a bit more cartoony and a bit more troublesome or troubled. Is that something that changes as his works Go on.
Or... Captain Grimes. Oh, well, I mean,
he's such a funny character.
He is very closely based on a real man. He is based on somebody called Dick Young. And when War came to write his autobiography, he did write lots of letters to people saying, can I talk about you? What can I say? What can I not say? And Dick Young at first said, yeah, say what you like. And then he backtracked and was like, oh, actually, I'm living in an almshouse and I'm living on someone else's charity and they're good people. And if they read what I got up to, then I'm going to be out on my ear. So please don't mention like my name. So he refers to him as Captain Grimes. So yes, he's an alcoholic. He's a pederast. So he's like a massively, I mean, there was a really good adaptation of Decline and Fall a couple of years ago starring Jack Whitehall. It was absolutely fantastic. Mm. And the guy who played Grimes was wonderful. His name's escaped me. Can anyone supply it? Because he was great. I'd love to shout him out because he was wonderful.
I can stand anything but saying yeah. Jack Whitehall was good. I can't.
I can't
permit that to go ahead. Yeah, I know.
Taboos on this show.
Just generally in all roles.
Oh yeah,
roles.
No, I have to. Okay. I will have to.
As a collection of cells, he is not a good.
Okay. All right. So the screenplay was very well realised.
Yeah, I'm just a bitter old Marxist. Don't. That's all I've got is this podcast. Don't take any notice of me. You go ahead and praise Jack Whitehall.
Okay, well, I think I was done because I actually really wanted to praise the guy who played Grimes anyway, if that was what we were talking about.
All right, who played Grimes?
Can't remember, and it's...
But it's a good indication of like how he mined his own life for his novel. So after he left Oxford, he got a job in a school in North Wales and he based Decline and Fall on those experiences. And that, it's just so funny. And I love this, another little anecdote is he goes back to meet his friend Harold Acton, who's the model for Anthony Blanche. And he reads the first 50 pages and Harold Acton is crying with laughter. He just thinks it's just the most funny thing. And it just, what I love about it is how he uses those autobiographical details and weaves them in. It's not very nice about the Welsh, is he?
I've just had a quick Google, and it was Douglas Hodge.
Yeah. I did it too.
Yes. but I think what I was going to say about that, he sort of preys on the young boys. He's an alcoholic. But what they did in the beat, they didn't feel that they could tackle all the elements of that character in this kind of primetime drama. So they had him as a sort of willing partner in kind of same-sex relationships with young men, but not criminally young men. So that was quite an interesting way. They kind of softened the character and made him more palatable. And so, yeah, so, I can tell you as well that in the manuscript, he was even more kind of explicitly kind of sexually predatory than he is in the published version of the book.
All alcoholics are...
I mean, I don't know. I think the narrative still kind of approves of him. And that is, you know, his whole, you know, there's this line. Well, actually, I don't want to spoil the book for you.
Yes.
But there is a quotation that says Captain Grimes was of the immortals. There's this idea that he can always get out of any scrape. And there's a kind of grudging admiration for that. That he's sort of dreadful. He kind of falls through life in this kind of alcoholic kind of criminal haze. But he always seems to land on his feet.
And I think what got him out of trouble a lot was that he was a private school boy, wasn't it? It was like,
I'm a public school man. I'm a public school man.
The brilliant joke about that is he'll just go from private school to private school to private school because nobody wants to tell the parents that they've got a pedophile in their.
Oh, shit.
And that's the satire right there. It's like, how many I know that's not that particular offence, but yes, there are people that you just want to get rid of. With the least bother possible.
And there's a parallel with the Catholic Church there a little bit as well with some of the...
It wasn't deliberately making that point at the time, but then later on there's clearly a number of people...
I'm nearly done. My second question, what is an aesthete? You've heard it three times. I don't know what it is.
So basically, when he went up to Oxford, there were sort of two camps. There were like the hearties, and the hearties were the boys who played football and who they were sort of muscular and quite thick. And then the aesthetes loved aesthetic things, so art, literature, music. So Alexi Sales an aesthete, I would say.
I'm both. Yeah. My heart
with a little bit of hearty. And so they became known as, in the 20s, this other group that were new to Oxford. Like, they wore Oxford bags, their clothing was very different. They were quite outwardly camp because they were trying to express their homosexuality, and they were known as the aesthetes. Other people would call them pansies, you know, less flatteringly, but they sort of set themselves apart from the hearties as the intellectuals. And this is what War was responding to in Brideshead, and when he went up to Oxford, was that he felt at home again. He thought, these are the people who love art, who love books, who love music, who talk about these things. So that's
so this is why... Yeah, so this is why it's so, like, the bit where he's not Harold Acton, he's based on Harold Acton, Anthony Blanche, is like reciting poetry, and he's reciting it to the rowers, isn't he? So it's actually like those, the two sides of Oxford, he's like reciting poetry, you know, like you would to a bunch of, we might call them jocks or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, like jocks and nerds.
But he's also, it's also a cautionary tale about the seductive, I don't know, in a way, the seductive power of the upper class, because Anthony Blanche makes that speech about the charm of the Marchmans, their fatal charm of the Marchmans, doesn't he, really? You know, how seductive it is, and in a sense, it'll lure you to your
doom. I think that's a really good point, because Charles has to reject, when he gives Sebastian money for alcohol, he's turned out of the house, you know, in a very sort of dramatic scene. And Charles says, I never want to see the Marchmains again. And I think he says the spell has been broken. So there is a sense that he's been enchanted by their beauty and by their wealth and their luxury. And then he actually sees them for what they are, which is their very broken family whose son's an alcoholic, and nobody wants to talk about it or admit it because it looks like a flaw. And you really get, so Charles has to break away from that. And then, of course, he meets Julia. So I'm glad you raised that, because, again, War was very conscious of that superficial charm, how it sucks you in, how it's beautifully seductive and glamorous and alluring, the sort of alluring these people. And yet these.
And, of course, Anthony Blunt also makes the point about, which is about the Charles's paintings contain, they're essentially vacuous, aren't they? That they contain the same charm, you know, which again is a brilliant kind of elision of two points, I think. And he's a shit painter, really.
Well, he's a hack painter.
Yeah, but it's so, you see that so often, don't you? You know, I think Anthony Blanche makes, I can't remember the exact speech, but about nobody else sees it, that the kind of, these are these pretty paintings that Charles has done that essentially are about nothing, really. You know.
Well, and I think he does. The enemy is insincerity. The enemy, yeah.
He's painting glamorous houses, and it's a wonderful symbol, because he himself was drawn into Brideshead, and then he spends his career painting stately homes. And Anthony Blanche says, "Oh, come on, Charles, you know they're rubbish," and he knows they're rubbish. He knows that, you know. He knows Anthony Blanche has got him, and he admits to it in that wonderful scene.
Any other questions?
One more, and thanks for explaining what an aesthete is. Last thing, because like I said, I'm only halfway through the first book, but what have I got to look forward to in terms of how his writing evolves over the years through all the books? Does he have a change in style? And
oh God, yeah. I mean, that's one of the things, again, sorry, I'm jumping in, but I mean, it's one of the things that, again, is so interesting about him, is that he starts off as this satirist, really. I mean, then, and they're complex portrayals, but then the later books are more, I don't know, much more multi-layered, I think. I don't know, I mean, am I being unfair to the early books? I don't know.
Well, it's one of those things that's easy to do, isn't it? Say, oh, the early work, the later work.
Yeah.
And I mean, he's very concerned with elegance in writing, as we've been saying all along, and he's very concerned with style. So I guess, like in anything, if you do it for, you know, 30 years, 40 years, I reckon you could say, was his main sort of writing span. You would hope you would get better. If you try and do it for 40 years, you would hope that you would.
Given in my business. But
yeah, maybe.
Or in any art, really, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
It's quite interesting that when he was writing Brideshead, he said it was his magnum opus, and he thought it was his best work. And he says, Nancy Miff said, oh, it's a great English classic. They called it his GEC. And then years later, when he was rewriting an introduction for the Penguin edition to come full circle here, he actually said, oh gosh, reading it again, I found it suffused with a sort of gluttony that I now found distasteful. And he was basically saying that during the years of deprivation of the war, the spam years, he said, you know, we ate spam. Mm.
He wrote soybeans and basic English.
Basic English grub, you know, it was a longing for caviar and champagne. And he now found it sickening to his palate. He said he found it sickening reading it. So it's quite interesting that he felt that he'd grown in the writing of Bride's Head, but then rejected. He said it was too saccharine, too emotional, not what he wanted at all. He'd become quite bitter by then, I think. He'd become very embittered, and he was over-reliant on and addicted to alcohol. And I think that he became very bitter about his writing. And in some ways, he probably thought Decline and Fall was the most perfect book, you know, at that time.
Really?
So it's quite interesting that he himself said, I find it distasteful.
I think he's wrong, really, though, isn't he?
I think he's wrong.
Thank you. That was amazing. I mean, I in a way, I was just thinking as we were talking that I could just talk forever about individual characters, really, just and their storylines. I've forgotten the guy Couchback, who's the woman that she gets pregnant by Trimmer and whole story.
His wife.
His wife.
Yeah.
Well, what's her name?
Bloody hell. No, we'll get it. We must know Guy Couchback's wife's name. Come on now.
I've forgotten.
Oh, gosh. This
Virginia
is
Troy.
Virginia Troy.
But her whole, the tragedy of her own whole storyline.
Do you want to know a fun fact that you might not know about all that?
Yeah, go on.
So Guy, at the end of the trilogy, marries Domenica. So Virginia is...
It's a happy ending, really, which is...
Well, this is it, you see, because he didn't like the happy ending. He wanted to go back and edit it so that Guy and Domenica didn't have any children of their own, but he never got a chance to do it. And there is actually a version of the text where they've half made the change and half...
Really?
Because he marked it up in one place that they had no kids, and in another part, they do.
So, because he's adopted Virginia Troy's child.
So he wanted, actually, he thought it was a better, more ironic ending if he is, you know, Trimmer's child is his only heir.
Right.
He thought that was a more kind of complex, rich...
I personally like that it's a kind of unalloyed happy ending, really. Like as Arthur Boxbender says, you know, things have turned out very well for Guy.
Well, exactly. That's what he hated. He was like, no. That's the thing. Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing. He had this kind of double edge on him where he was like, oh, my books are my own. They're, you know, they're for other people to comment on, make what you will of them. But then sometimes people would say things to him like, oh, I'm glad it was a happy ending. He was like, no, that's not what I wanted. And then he'd go back and kind of change it.
Oh, yeah, it's that sort of
thing. That's just a fun fact.
The world belongs to Hooper and to Trimmer. And I think he saw that the new modern man would not have the glamour of the flights. They would, the Trimmers, the Hoopers are going to inherit the earth. And he hated that, actually. He actually found those men lacking in any grace or charisma or real intelligence. They're grasping men, and they're not romantic. And that's the romantic in him, you see. It's very easy to say, oh, what a snob. He doesn't want Hooper because Hooper's working class. It was kind of didn't want the lack of glamour. He just was still drawn to glamour. He still wanted...
Well, it's of the bureaucracy as well, isn't it, that he doesn't like. It's the kind of... Yeah.
Well, he was certainly prescient about that. I mean, we've got a government full of Trimmers, haven't we?
Well, it's the call centre sadness, you know. It's that kind of thing that, you know.
But I agree with Alexia. I feel like we've just skimmed the surface here. I feel like...
Yeah, well, maybe we'll do... We can do a part two, really. We'll see how... Because, you know, mostly my podcast is either about shenanigans in the Labour Party or stand-up comedy or... warfare and weapons.
Yeah.
So this is a bit of a digression, really.
Well, we have done a Brecht.
Isn't it all of those things?
We have done a Brecht episode.
I saw that you'd done a Brecht.
How would you do a Brecht? Yeah.
I didn't listen to it, but I saw that you'd done it.
I think this is part two in that kind of series of like focus on on older literature that maybe people today aren't as familiar with as they should be. And I hope our listeners at home, like I'm doing, are going to try and familiarize themselves with War's work.
Well, we'll put this out to our focus groups, analyze our demographic And if our demographic approves of Evelyn Waugh, maybe we can do a part two, because I would certainly love to. I mean, every single character in Waugh, more or less, and their storyline, we haven't covered Chatty Corner, we haven't covered, you know, the Jumbo Trotter. We there's so many different characters we haven't even talked about, really. So, but thank you very much. Anyway, thank you both very much.
Thank you, it's a pleasure.
Paula and Barbara. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers. So that, I thought, for me, that was amazing. I don't know how you feel about it, I love everything to do with Evelyn Waugh. I love him as much as I ever did, but in a different way. And I would like to say thanks to Paula and to Barbara, and bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Anthony Overton for the sound mixing. And to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.